This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When her book, Brain in a Jar, was published, Nancy Stearns Burcott joined us to talk about her father's life and his struggle with Alzheimer's disease. One of the things she highlighted was the effect his disease had on her family. And Burcott listed three of what she calls family catastrophes.
The first is the loss of the mental capacity of the person that you love, and then is the horrendous effect on the family, especially the caregiver. And if you're not a caregiver, you don't know how unbearably difficult that is. And if you're trying to shoulder it all without assistance from your siblings, or at least being on the same page, it is the second catastrophe. And then trying to decide whether you can afford to put your loved one into a memory care clinic. And that brings me to the third catastrophe, the economic problems of this disease. While we're waiting for a cure, we have some philosophical problems to resolve. Who's going to take care of whom and with what money?
That's Vermont writer Nancy Burcott talking about her experiences supporting her father through Alzheimer's disease. What Nancy illustrates is how difficult the disease is, not only for the person suffering from it, but for all the family members and caregivers who surround him. Their suffering is sometimes less visible, and caregivers sometimes feel guilty for what they might think is complaining about caring for their loved one and the losses that they feel. We're going to talk about that today, and we invite you, if you're feeling isolated or if you'd just like to share a perspective, to write to us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. And we're joined now by Jesse Cornell, Director of Community Outreach for the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Jesse, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
And by Sheila Dooley, who lives in Fairfax, and she cares for her husband, Jim, who has Alzheimer's. Sheila, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So for both of you, did Nancy Burcott's descriptions of catastrophes resonate with you? Do you think that made sense, Sheila?
It did with me. It's very true that when the diagnosis comes down, you feel overwhelmed and you're not sure which direction to take. But what you need to do is kind of pick yourself up and look at what you do have and go in a direction that's a positive.
Jesse, what about for you?
Absolutely. So many caregivers mirror what Nancy has shared. And I think she outlines the catastrophes in a way that helps those who have not yet been impacted personally to have a slight insight into that experience.
Anything you'd add to that in terms of other catastrophes?
I think that there's moments that are catastrophes in themselves, but I think she's got the overarching themes, absolutely.
So, Sheila, I'd love for you to explain, as I mentioned, you care for your husband, Jim. He's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Can you talk a little bit about what you first noticed, you and Jim, that led you to pursue a diagnosis in the first place?
Well, for us, we're probably a little different than most families because my husband's mother had Alzheimer's. And he entered into a research study with Johns Hopkins in 2000 with his sister. And every 3 years, he and his sister would go to Johns Hopkins and be tested. And it was in 2013 that he went to be tested, and he failed. And I knew he was going to fail because before that, he was struggling. He was struggling with appointments. He was struggling with a computer. He was getting anxious and frustrated very easily. So when I got the diagnosis from Johns Hopkins and they said you need to go home and speak to go to a neurologist, I knew that was coming. And when we did get the final diagnosis, it made sense for him. Even though he was angry, it gave him a reason as to why he was doing what was happening to him.
So you were both noticing that he was having some memory trouble and some trouble on the computer and that
yes.
kind of thing.
Yes.
And mood changes as well? Were those early on?
I didn't notice the mood changes as much. Maybe some depression.
Hmm. Jesse, is that a pretty typical early phase of Alzheimer's?
I would say yes. The symptomology is very common. What is unique in Sheila and Jim's story is that they have a relationship that allows for open dialogue, and and insightfulness and awareness to each other's roles in that relationship. And not everyone has that advantage in their dynamics in terms of who they're interacting with. So when someone might have a gut feeling that something is off, if you don't have the confidence or the open door to talk about it, chances are you might shut down and become defensive and not outspoken about your concerns because you feel so vulnerable.
They also had, you know, had Jim, as you said, in this program yes. where they were already checking to see if Alzheimer's might be, you know, coming on.
That's correct. Yeah.
So what is it about your relationship with Jim that allowed you both to be so open and to have a conversation about this?
Well, Jim was a VA counselor for 22 years. I think that's a big part of it. And we both are very open with our communication to each other. We always have been. And I think what we say to each other when we see, like when I see him kind of wobbling a little bit, I'll say to him, we need to talk. And he'll look at me like, okay. So, and he'll do the same thing to me because I have problems too. I mean, I get frustrated and he'll say, we need to talk. And when we sit down and talk, sometimes it's uncomfortable in the beginning. But we usually resolve what the conflict is that's going on between us.
Beyond personal conflicts, how do you have conversations about what things might be like in a couple of years when the disease progresses and his condition deteriorates? You know, how do you have conversations about you're not going to be able to drive forever or we're going to have to talk about having somebody else come and help me when I need a break? How do you do those?
Those are hard ones. And we just went through a whole situation where we met with a social worker. My husband's a veteran, and he was disabled in Vietnam in 1968. He detonated a grenade, so he had some injuries. So we met with a social worker at the VA, and we had discussions on caregiving and that, you know, maybe down the road, you know, we might need to have a facility or we might need people coming into our home to help. And he was okay with that at the time, but we got home from that visit and he was really upset and he was quiet. And I said to him, are you okay? And he said, no. He said, I feel like a piece of meat. So we talked about it and I said, we need to have these conversations while you can be a part of it because this is your life. So you need to have a say in what happens to you because it is your life.
And that made sense?
It did. It helped.
How has that changed the way you've approached what you think you might do in the future?
I think just by having the open conversation, I'm able to know what road we're going to take because he's making decisions with me. I'm not doing it alone right now.
Jesse, I imagine that's something that you try to impress upon people, you know, even in the beginning of what can be a very overwhelming diagnosis, to try to have those conversations as difficult as they may be. Why is it important to do that in a family context where the person who has Alzheimer's and the people who are going to be caring for that person are hashing these things out together?
I'd really like to highlight two things that Sheila shared. You know, one, accessing resources like the social worker. Now, not everyone is a veteran. We certainly know that they don't have that particular resource, but there are mediators out there. There are clinical social workers that you can contact in the community. The Alzheimer's Association has a 24-hour helpline that has licensed master's level clinicians available to have those dialogues if need be. And it's absolutely free and confidential. Making sure that the person is involved in as much of the conversation as possible empowers them to give direction to their life. It also allows for the processing of the anger that may not come out unless they're involved and asked about their opinions and preferences, wants, desires, needs. And that anger may simmer if it's not given an outlet. So I think it's very healthy, uncomfortable, but very healthy. And in terms of inviting the care team, as I call them, to be a part of those conversations, if you're in a dyad like Sheila and Jim, husband and wife, start those conversations there. But then if there are children or close friends or close neighbors that are involved in this, invite them to the table too, because the conversations that you have as a couple, if they're not extended or communicated to those other individuals in your care team, there can be questions that come up later on and concerns about, well, what really was said? What really was Dad's preference here? And if it's all out in the open as to what that plan may be, it's a lot easier for everyone to feel connected, decrease resentment, and those, again, to use that term, simmering difficulties that unless we address right away, they may come to a head at a completely different situation, but they've been boiling so long, they're bound to impact the conversation at hand.
Sheila, I would imagine as well, you know, as you sort of alluded to, you want your partner to be able to make decisions for his own life while he can. In the event that he is not able to make them later on, you want to know that you're doing what he wants and what some of his wishes are.
That's correct. Yes.
So, Jesse, what about in the situation where, you know, the people may be talking, a family may be talking, and the person who's had the diagnosis of Alzheimer's says, I don't want to go into a memory care setting, or I don't want anybody else in the home. And you've had, you know, conversations with people who say, I agreed to that, and now, you know, her disease has progressed to a point where I can't care for my loved one on my own, but I have all of this guilt, and I had promised I wouldn't put her in a memory care apartment or in a you know, have somebody else come in and help me. How do you deal with that?
I think starting with the education around this idea of not making the promise, as you called it, because it's such a good way to describe it. None of us, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or not, have a crystal ball that can tell us what the future is going to look like. So if we can best prepare ourselves for the alternate possibilities, we can put plans into place that are the best fit for everyone involved. But if your loved one is just adamant that that is not their preference, it's okay to acknowledge that, but it's just as important to acknowledge that that might not be the reality of the situation. And depending on the level of cognitive ability, you can go in and have a deeper conversation with your loved one about this. There are points in the disease, and let me say here that the disease impacts everyone very differently. And it all has to do with not only the trajectory of the disease and what's happening within the brain, but also who that person is and how they process to begin with. What's their insight level? What's their empathy level? So not everybody's going to respond in the same way. But one would hope that if we have those open conversations and just acknowledge the reality of, I would like to control the situation so that you do not have to go into a memory care community, or that we do not have to ask folks to come into the home. But with a disease like Alzheimer's disease, that's not always manageable. And for those of you who have managed to do that, you must have a superhero cape that you've been hiding from the rest of us, because it takes a community around this particular disease. And many, many people living with the diagnosis, if the discussion has begun early enough, do have awareness as to what that is going to do to their care partner or their spouse or their daughter, and will make accommodations for that in what they're planning for their own future.
We're talking today about Alzheimer's disease, and we'd love to hear from you if you have an experience you'd like to share. We're specifically looking at how the care community, family, and loved ones around a person who has this diagnosis are affected, and how you can communicate with your family and try to work through this disease, which certainly can be devastating to families, in a way that, you know, that you do it with love and care. So I'd love to hear from you if you have an experience to share with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Dave who says, one of the worst problems I had in caring for my father was that his doctors refused to tell me that he had Alzheimer's. When I asked why his mental condition was deteriorating, I got nothing but double talk. I think many doctors still erroneously believe that people don't want to know if they have Alzheimer's or not. That's horrible, because it's important to plan for the future. Dave says, I had someone call Adult Protective Services on me because I was going along with the doctor's diagnosis of a non-progressive memory loss and not getting more supervision for my father. Jesse Cornell, can you address that? How when you're not necessarily getting all of the information from a doctor, how can you address that?
First, let me say, Dave, thank you for sharing your story, and also acknowledge that we all do the best we can with what we have when we have it. So if you can find a little bit of relief in that saying, I hope that to be the case. You know, there is a statistic that was recently published in the 2015 Facts and Figures, that's a report that's done by the National Alzheimer's Association, that indicates that less than 45% of people living with a form of dementia are not told of their diagnosis. And that also includes their primary care partner. So maybe the person with the disease is not being told, but no one else in their family is either. And as Dave's story illustrates, that can cause all sorts of community havoc, not to mention safety concerns. So if you have a feeling that something is amiss and your physician is telling you one thing, and you're not getting a response from them, it is perfectly appropriate to seek out a second opinion. And it doesn't always have to be a specialist. Primary care physicians are taught and should be able to give you a very accurate diagnosis. I mean, just to dispel a myth for a moment, it is no longer necessary to do an autopsy to be confident that it is dementia of the Alzheimer's type.
And if you, I mean, what about the HIPAA laws? And do you have to get permission from the patient then to be given all of the medical records and diagnoses?
That's by far the best way to go. You're going to have the least resistance through that path. It's going to streamline your communication abilities. Even if it's not a progressive type of dementia, it's still a positive step to take in that direction. I have suggested to family members that if they feel like they're let's just say daughter or father scenario, if a dad is not communicating to the physician the concerns that he has or the concerns that you've shared with dad, they're not reaching the physician, even with HIPAA laws intact, you can send a letter to that office and say, I understand that you are the provider for my father. I would like you to know that these are my concerns. This is what we're seeing on a daily basis. I recognize that he may present quote unquote normal during his office visit with you, but these are the very real things that we're struggling with. We're very concerned and we'd like to work together on this.
Sheila Dooley, how do you deal with that? You know, while allowing Jim to have his autonomy, how do you then approach medical appointments and what you need to know?
I go to all of his medical appointments. That was determined by both of us, that we go to both of them. I mean, that I go to all of his appointments so that he has the best care because he doesn't hear everything. And the doctors, and he doesn't know how to communicate what's going on sometimes. So I communicate for him. And I have put myself on his medical record, you know, his doctor's permission for everything, like hospital doctors, the VA, just so that I can be part of all of his care. And I think it's important because, like Jesse said, sometimes somebody can go to a doctor's appointment and act perfectly normal. But if somebody's sitting there saying, I see some changes here, you know, oh, you did this, you did this, you did this. And that way you're kind of, you know, you're not ratting them out. You're just helping them.
Again, today we're talking about the experience of caring for someone who has Alzheimer's disease. And coming up, we're going to talk a little bit with Sheila Dooley about how does somebody in the caregiver role preserve her own sanity and her own emotional health and well-being? How do you reach out when you need help or when you want to talk about the very real losses that you're also experiencing, not only in your partnership, but perhaps in your own autonomy and life? Listeners, we'd love for you to weigh in as well. We know many of you have experience with this. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post your experiences and thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Jesse Cornell, Director of Community Outreach for the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and with Sheila Dooley, who lives in Fairfax with her husband, Jim, who has Alzheimer's. We're talking about the experience of caring for someone through this degenerative disease and the effect it has not only on the patient, but on loved ones as well. You can share your experience or ask a question. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Sheila Dooley, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the joys and challenges, because I know there are joys still of living with somebody who has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and I don't want to pretend that it's all bad news all the time, but I do want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges and, you know, maybe hoping that you could talk a little bit about your emotional journey in trying to figure out how to be a spouse and a partner and still your own person as you and Jim move through this diagnosis and journey together.
That's a big one. There is a lot of joy because Jim and I learned to laugh a lot. And you bring humor into this. You know, you try not to look at the dark side. You look at the bright side. And that's one of the things that has helped us journey through our diagnosis. And as far as, like, it's a struggle. I can't say that it isn't a struggle. I find myself wanting to cry sometimes, and I feel if I do, I'm not going to stop. But then I say, well, this is our journey. This is what we're doing. So let's see what we can do with this, and keep talking. I'm a talker, so I talk to my friends. I talk to my my husband. I talk to people I meet on the path when I walk my dog. And I think getting the word out is what's helping me. If I don't do what I'm doing now and today, speaking today, I feel like I feel helpless. But by speaking today and getting the word out about Alzheimer's, that don't leave us behind. There's a statement my husband made. As a soldier, he learned, you leave no one behind. And what I'm saying today is, don't forget us as Alzheimer families. Don't leave us behind. And by speaking today, I feel like I'm empowered. And if I can help somebody, even one person, then I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing. And I think that's the best thing that I can do.
Do you feel like families are left behind?
I do. I think a lot of people hide. I think when they're given the diagnosis, it's so overwhelming that they don't know where to turn. And one of the things that I thought would be helpful for families is having a care team. And if there was a care team with social worker, counselor, dietitian, occupational therapist, even speech therapist, because one of the things that happens with Alzheimer's is they lose their speech. So you have to learn to speak in short sentences and clearly. And you might have to repeat. and it becomes more interesting, especially if there's a hearing deficiency. So you just have to speak over again. But it's okay. You know, you just keep doing it. And the biggest thing to remember is patience. Patience, patience, patience. Because think of what they're going through.
What about socially? You know, how would you talk to friends who know that another friend of theirs has been diagnosed, and how to maintain a friendship when, you know, it can feel awkward and you don't necessarily want to sound like you're patronizing, but you may not also be involved enough to know exactly how to deal with your friends or their partners and family members?
Well, because we're part of a group called In Harmony, so we're with other couples that have either dementia or Alzheimer's, we've learned to how to speak in a way that is helpful but not overpowering. We don't tell people what to do. We just advise, this is what we did. This is what worked for us. I'm not saying this will work for you, but this is what worked for us. So you kind of give them ideas of what might be a proper way to go. But it doesn't mean it might work for them. There might be another way. So you just give them... What I do is I just give them places to look. Like I say, go to the Alzheimer's Association, you know, call them. They're the biggest source.
Jesse, what do you think about that?
I see so many social relationships take a nosedive. I'll be frank about it. And it's sad to me because it's not a lack of caring. It's a lack of education and comfort. And there's an old phrase called sitting with the ugly, and that's when you have to work through the difficult piece. And so if you have good relationships or friendships that have grown over time, I urge you to put the effort in, but recognize that you as the friend may have to step to the plate because the person or the couple with the diagnosis may be a little overwhelmed. But on the other hand, the family that's living with the diagnosis, please don't let go. Oddly enough, you might have to work harder to maintain that relationship, but it'll be worth it. You'll find out who your real friends are. And if you give them the tools to stay in your life, chances are they're going to. And by tools, I might mean being open with how communication has changed. You know, I've found that with Jim, I need to use shorter sentences and I need to be patient in waiting for a response for him. So if you give that information to your friends, it won't be awkward to sit down and have that conversation. And for the friends that are involved, you know, many people will call and say, you know, my neighbors have are facing Alzheimer's disease and I don't know what to do for them. I don't know how to ask them about it, because if I ask them about it, well, it's probably going to be bad. How are you guys doing? It's probably not a joyous mm-hmm. moment, but there are moments of kayaking and mm-hmm. sailing and being who you always have been. Those will stay if you work at them. But I suggest to family and friends and neighbors who are looking to make that connection to, instead of saying, how are things going, opening the conversation with, I just wanted you to know I've been thinking about you. And that allows for the family to then ask if they have a need, or to share information or emotions if that's what they're needing, or if they're not in a space where they want to talk about Alzheimer's, because it doesn't have to be 24/7 in that scenario. Talk about the golf match that you watched.
Let's weigh in with some of our listeners who have experiences to share as well. Molly says, my father developed the disease in his early 60s. I was only 11 years old at the time, and I served as his caregiver for a few years before he entered a veteran's home. So unfortunate for him and our family. My entire life changed because of this disease, and I've never really come to grips with it now that I think about it. And let's hear from Janice, who's calling in from White River Junction. Hi, Janice. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. We gotcha.
Hello?
Hi, Janice. Can you hear me? Oh, I think we don't
Hello?
Have Janice on the other end of the line. Let's go to Joan and see if we have Joan on the line with mm-hmm. us. Hi, Joan. Can you hear
yes.
me?
You do have Joan.
Good. Go right ahead.
I'm in Brattleboro. I want to just wage a question of caution. I came to Brattleboro. My mother was here in a nursing home, and my sister was leaving, had to leave town. So I came here, and I found out immediately that my mother was being over-medicated. It was very clear to me, and I had to fight and everything. But I finally got her to be able to come home with me and was able to take her to a geriatric unit at Franklin Hospital, geriatric psychiatric. And the psychologist there actually was the one who determined that what she had was not Alzheimer's, which they assume that everybody has if there's not some clear physical problem or something. But what my mother had was Lewy body dementia. More people know about it today than did, this was 10 years ago, but it's amazing how many people still don't know about it. And it's sort of like a combination of characteristics of both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And the key thing, I'd say the most important thing, is that often when people get upset and everything with Alzheimer's, they've found that for a lot of people, a certain amount of neuroleptic medication helps. But my mother would get worse after they gave it to her. She'd fall asleep and then wake up and was worse. And what turned out, in Parkinson's, they make it very clear you should never use a neuroleptic medication. And the same thing is true with Lewy body.
Joan, I hear what you're saying, and I want to pull this back over to Jesse Cornell, because I really appreciate your perspective, and I'm glad that you shared it with us. And Jesse, I think this goes back to what you were saying earlier, what both of you have talked about, in being a real advocate for your loved one, for your family member, in trying to make sure that they are getting the best medical care. And that might mean being as up-to-date as possible as you can with what's actually going on in their medical care.
Absolutely, Joan, and thank you so much for your doing your due diligence with accessing the appropriate diagnosis for your mother. It's important to recognize that while we're called the Alzheimer's Association, our full name is the Alzheimer's Association and Related Dementias. So recognizing that we can help clarify when there are symptoms that you're unsure about. So working with your physician to give them a broad range of understanding of what's happening in the home, not just what's showing in the office or in the care setting, and making sure that we're really striving for an accurate diagnosis, not just one that says dementia, because that term dementia really is a catchphrase for several different types of symptoms that can be brought about by multiple types of diseases or medical issues that are occurring. So advocating for an accurate and an early diagnosis is the best thing possible.
Sheila Dooley, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you feel empowered by being able to speak today and by being able to share your experiences and advocate for your family, for you and for Jim and for people who are going through this. What else do you want people to know about the family members that you say often get left behind?
I think they need to be spoken to. I think that you need to talk. I think that their children, if there's children, cousins, nephews, nieces, you know, whoever, talk to the family. Just open the conversation. Don't forget them. Don't leave them in their home by themselves. Don't isolate them.
That's Sheila Dooley. She lives in Fairfax with her husband, Jim, who has Alzheimer's disease. Thank you for sharing your personal experience with us today.
You're welcome.
Jesse Cornell is the Director of Community Outreach for the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, when is a road not a road? Or maybe it is a road. We'll explain how ancient roads have been mapped and kept or discarded all around the state. And we'll talk with one Granville resident who took it upon himself to document all of his town's official thoroughfares throughout history. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Most towns have their fair share of winding, overgrown pathways that seemingly lead to nowhere. But until recently, those trails could still be considered legal roads, which sometimes led to confusion with landowners, not to mention cartographers and town planners. So the Vermont legislature took action. Towns had 5 years to determine whether or not they wanted to keep ancient roads on the books. And as of July 1st, any road that is not officially included in the state highway map is no longer a road. In Granville, Norman Arsenault was instrumental in figuring out what should be a road and what should be relegated to history. He studied all of the roads in Granville's history, and he joins me now. Hi, Norm. Norm, can you hear me? All right, well, I hear you. So we're going to talk for just a minute while in our control room we try to get Norm Arsenault on the line with us. So here's the deal. There was Act 178, and one of the things that had been happening in Vermont was that there were these roads, these pathways that had been on the books. And in Vermont bylaws, basically any road that was ever considered a road was still considered a road. And so you had these byways that traipsed through people's yards, and they were considered roads even though nobody ever actually used them for a road. So this was what the law was supposed to fix. And again, in Granville, Norm Arsenault was one of the people who attempted to figure out what might be a road and what might not be. And Norm, I guess we have you on the line now. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Thank you. You're saving me from myself. So Norm, what made you say, yeah, I want to study all of Granville's roads throughout history?
Well, it kind of suited my talents and my interests. I'm a kind of a map freak, you could say, and I like doing surveying type work. I'm a professional forester. I've worked in the woods for a long time. I like being out there searching for evidence of various things. And so when I saw Act 178 coming along, I thought, you know, this is something the town of Granville needs. And it just fired me up, I guess you'd say.
So, you know, I mentioned that in some cases landowners were having trouble, you know, figuring out what was a property boundary because the town might still have on the books that this was at one point a road going through their front yard. Did you have disputes like that in Granville?
We didn't have any disputes at the time, but I saw them occurring in neighboring towns, and obviously the potential was there for creating that kind of difficulty because people didn't know whether an old road was, in fact, a surveyed official town right-of-way or not. And that was one of the reasons I approached the select board about proceeding with a pretty aggressive program about searching the records and finding out the facts on all of our roads.
So can you pick out one interesting road that you researched and tell me the story of it?
Well, one of the interesting roads situations involved two roads. One was an early road surveyed in 1832, which I call a Luther Robinson Road because that is name is mentioned in the survey as one of the landowners. And then later on in the 1880s, a new road was authorized by the select board, which I call the Bagley Barn Road. And the Bagley Barn Road created a new shortcut, so it superseded part of the earlier road, but it of course, none of this is in the record. It doesn't say that. So, but what both, so they discontinued part of the earlier survey to a point where there was a large maple tree, and that's what they say, to the maple tree. And they started the survey on the new road in 1882 from the large maple tree. Well, you know, we've only got 36,000 acres in this town or something like that. Where's that maple tree?
Right, quite a few maple trees to choose from.
So the maple tree was something like a short distance from a barn foundation which belonged to Cyrenus Bagley. So by tracing and finding where Cyrenus Bagley lived on old maps and so forth, and then going out there, find the maple tree, find a junction of the roads, then you come to the conclusion of actually what happened, and you found the location on the ground.
So you were finding these roads. I mean, you were documenting them, but presumably some of them are now no longer considered official roads in Granville, because part of the point of this was to discontinue roads that are no longer in use and that really shouldn't be considered roads.
Yes. The law prescribed that if you had an old survey, which was a legal public road, which was not on your town highway map, and if you did not reestablish it on your town highway map by July 1st of this year, it would be extinguished, so-called. But that's only for roads that are called termed unidentified corridors, meaning you can't see the roadway. In fact, in Granville, we ended up with my guess being we had 9 old surveys that were extinguished by Act 178 on July 1. And that's out of something like 77 original surveys starting in 1790. The thing we didn't know when we started doing the research is how many roads are going to be unidentified corridors versus roads that you could see. And the one astounding thing to me is surveys that were for road construction back as far as 1790s are extremely obvious out there on the ground. You can follow them. You can see the roadbed. They're still there.
That's so cool. Although I hear there's at least one road and bridge that you were not able to find, so it's still a mystery to you.
I have 4 mysteries left out of those original surveys. And in fact, just this week, one of our residents, because we have quite a number of local residents here who are interested in the history of these roads, of the towns. Of course, they pass by old mill foundations and cemeteries and like that, which are mentioned where I know about them in my book. But one fellow, Steve Mishkett, who is a Granville resident, has already come in and gotten the material, and he wants to find the one road that I have that is the most interesting to him, and he's started the search.
So we already know that there's going to be a second edition to your book. That's fabulous. If you want to know more about Granville's roads, Norm Arsenault's book is called A History of Granville Roads. He was instrumental in figuring out for the town what is a road, what isn't, and this history, this very rich history of where all the town's roads have been through time. Norman Arsenault, thank you so much for talking with us about it. How fascinating.
Well, I'm glad to do it, and thank you very much.
All right, and that will do it for today's show. Now, for many Vermonters, the quintessential sound of summer is the roar of the engines at Thunder Road and other racetracks. Devil's Bowl, anyone? Tomorrow, we're looking at the surprisingly rich history of auto racing in the Green Mountain State. If you are an aficionado, maybe you've been a racer yourself, we would love to hear your experiences, your historical remembrances. You can send questions as well and those comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, and then listen for the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.